After all, these are girls that are doing something so different with so much of their lives.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
This is part one of a two-part series with Susanna Schaefer.
I worked with Holt Associates for a number of years. Holt Associates was the organization that John Holt founded. John Holt, as some people may know, was an educational writer and critic who's probably best known for his books How Children Fail and How Children Learn. But in 1977, John Holt founded a little magazine called Growing Without Schooling. And quite a number of years later, after his death, I came to join the folks who were continuing to put out that magazine, and eventually I became the editor of Growing Without Schooling magazine and did that for a number of years. So got to keep quite close touch with John Holt's philosophy and ways of looking at children's learning and with the people who were practicing Growing Without Schooling all over North America and in other countries as well. At some point along the way there, I wrote a book about homeschooled adolescent girls in particular, and that book is called A Sense of Self. I was interested in looking at the experience of girls in particular at a time when the experience of girls in school was getting a great deal of attention. In the early and mid-90s, there were a number of books and studies and reports coming out looking at the experience of schooling for girls, and specifically asserting that girls were suffering in school in some very specific and particular ways. So that there was a study, for example, called How Schools Shortchange Girls, which was produced by the American Association of University Women. That's one example. There were other such studies and report research where girls had been interviewed. So that was being looked at very closely. Everything from specific school discrimination issues, like studies that showed that teachers called on boys when students raised their hands, you know, to be called on, that teachers called on boys much more frequently than they called on girls, and teachers were often not consciously aware of that behavior. They might say initially in an interview that they had no discrimination whatsoever based on gender, but then when they'd, let's say, be videotaped, and then they would sit and watch, teachers would watch a videotape of their own classroom behavior and realize to their shock that, in fact, they were favoring the boys. Mm. So that's just one example, you know, of the kind of research that was being done. There was some important research that was looking not specifically at school at all, but simply at adolescent girls' psychological growth and development and their inner experience. And there was a lot of discussion about girls losing their voice. That was the phrase that came out of the Harvard Project on the development of girls. The sense that adolescent girls really were losing trust in themselves, doubting their own voices, doubting the validity of their own goals and perceptions and experience. Those words sound kind of general, but it meant a lot of important things. And adolescence is a hard time for many young people. There was some attention to the particular ways it was hard on girls, the messages that the culture sends to girls, the ways in which school sometimes reinforces those messages, and the ways that girls, here's something that I can paint with a very broad brush, but it's kind of a generalization, but it would play out, I think it will resonate with a number of people, that, let's say, if a boy is struggling in school or struggling in general as an adolescent, that's often very visible. The boy, more classically, again, it's always dangerous to generalize. Of course, there are numerous exceptions to any generalization, but classically and typically, a boy might be, as they say, acting out. That a boy who, for whom school was not working, might be the disruptive one, the one that was making trouble in class, interrupting the teacher, in some way misbehaving, so that it would be very, very obvious that boy was having trouble and that the school setup was not working for him. He might be the one that's, you know, constantly getting sent to the principal's office. The girl in school, on the other hand, might look fine on the outside. Might be she's the one sitting quietly in the corner, not making any outward trouble. I give you tell a quick story that really illustrates this perfectly, that it, and really summed up this issue for me in a way that a girl I came to know well, eventually, who chose to leave school and become a homeschooler at 15. The final straw for her mother, this was a girl attending a regular conventional public high school, and one day she came home from school and her mother said, "How's it going?" You know, making conversation with her teenager, and the mother said, "What are you doing in science class nowadays?" And the girl said, "I don't know." And the mother said, "Well, how can you not know? You know, what do you mean? How can you not know what you're doing in class?" And the girl said, "I don't pay attention. You know, I spend the class staring out the window." And it's a simple anecdote, but therein lies what so many people were asserting was the issue with girls, that here was a girl that the teacher probably didn't even give much thought to, would not have necessarily cited as one of her problem students. I mean, after all, a girl who is looking out the window with her mind drifting in class is not necessarily making the kind of outward trouble that draws a teacher's attention. But here's a girl that is not being served by that experience, you know, not getting anything out of it, and not really making her needs or her problems or her struggles manifest in a way that gets any kind of attention from adults. So that's the kind of discrepancy. What with all those studies and reports and lots of, it was getting a lot of popular press attention, you know, these were university studies, but in the way that this sometimes happens, these things were getting very much picked up by the popular press, and so there was a lot of discussion about these issues. And what I noticed in following all of that, it was certainly of interest to me, I noticed that the assumption that girls go to school was a given. One of the studies even said, in passing, all girls go to school. That was simply the assumption. In other words, the point was, therefore, we need to look at the way that school treats girls, an extremely valid point. But meanwhile, I knew, of course, through my work and my interactions, I knew and dealt with, and in some cases worked closely with, girls who didn't go to school. In some cases, girls who had never gone to school a day in their lives, you know, who had grown up completely outside of that very typical experience. I was working with girls not only through the magazine Growing Without Schooling, but through discussion groups for teenagers and through mentoring young writers and so forth. So I had a lot of contact with girls, as it so happened. Again, I wasn't thinking in particular about girls. I was working with teenagers of both genders, but I was also aware of the girls that I knew well, and they didn't fit the descriptions that I was reading so much about. I would read about girls who were losing their voices, getting less confident, distrusting themselves, being alienated from any sense of their own goals, and that just kept not fitting the girls that I knew well. And, of course, they were having a very different experience. So I thought that it would be interesting and worthwhile as a contribution to this whole discussion to study girls who were learning outside of school and ask them many of the same interview questions, actually, that girls in some of these other studies had been asked, and see how that all came out. And that's what A Sense of Self was ultimately about. It was the result of 55 interviews with homeschooled girls age 11 to 16 across the United States, and they were in-depth interviews. You know, this wasn't a statistical study. It was what they call qualitative research, where it's all about the answers that the girls give in talking and reflecting and in conversation. And I did indeed find that the girls' experience was in many ways quite different from their peers in school.
Everyone
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
People talk about, you know, age 10 or so as being the kind of high point of girlhood, when a girl often feels very confident on top of the world. And then as the girl begins to absorb the cultural messages about what's expected of females in this culture, that things begin to get much harder, and she, as Carol Gilligan and her colleagues describe it, the girl sort of goes underground. She doesn't feel comfortable saying what she really thinks, focuses much more on what others want. This is all very much shorthand about a complicated psychological phenomenon, and I don't want to come across as overly glib about it, but that was what was being observed. And the girls that I was talking to were reporting the opposite. A 15-year-old girl might report that she felt more sure of herself, more trusting of her own experience than she had 3 years before, for example. You saw a different kind of progression. Another really classic distinction was the other studies had found that girls became increasingly uncomfortable with disagreement among friends, for example. You know, you think of the classic sort of sense we have of social life of girls in school, that it's very, very important to conform, to fit in, to go along with what the norms are, what the leader of your clique demands. And so that one of the interview questions is about how, for example, do you speak up when you disagree with a friend and that sort of thing. And that was a place where the homeschool girls were almost unanimous. There were maybe one or two exceptions in the 55 I interviewed, but almost across the board, they were expressed comfort with disagreement. They sort of expected to disagree with friends about one thing or the other and didn't assume that that precluded friendship. You know, after all, these are girls that are doing something so different with so much of their lives and so often having to explain themselves that if they needed to agree about everything with a friend, they'd have a very limited pool. So they become much more comfortable with that sort of thing, with being different and yet having relationships with people. They don't assume you have to be the same in order to have a close relationship. Although these questions, these interview questions on both sides look at something pretty internal and subjective and kind of emotional in a way, ultimately it's very much connected to the outer experience. So that, for example, this is a classic one that in some of the other discussions and studies and so forth, there's a frequently quoted story of a psychologist sitting with a girl from a private school, a pretty prestigious private school, and finding this girl to be very alienated from her goals. You know, in other words, outwardly successful, but not really identifying with it, not really seeing those goals that she's meeting as her own goals. And the psychologist, in this case, asks the question, how can we help girls to identify with their own goals and to feel more connected? And my point was, well, you know, schooling, conventional schooling, is not really based on that. Schooling is not about, traditionally, about helping people to identify their own goals and pursue them. It's, you know, school, speaking very generally, tells students, this is what you need to learn. This is how you're going to go about it. We will test to see if you have learned it, that sort of thing. In a homeschool environment, in a setting where you're learning outside of school, you are being asked to reflect on your own goals. You are learning to ask the question, what do I want out of life? You know, not just out of education, but what do I want? What do I care about? What seems important to pursue? What do I need to know in order to pursue that? Those are the questions, as a homeschool teenager of any gender, that you're being invited and supported to ask. So if those students eventually then feel much more confident and more identified with their goals, it's not actually surprising. There's a relationship between those two things. With teenagers, of course, you get into a different kind of situation. Potentially, a teenager doesn't need the same kind of direct custodial care that a 5 or 6-year-old does. In other words, they can safely be outside of their parents' line of vision for long stretches of time. And so it becomes an interesting societal question. What are the options? What do we do with young people who, let's say, we don't want them in the workplace yet, but they don't need the kind of direct supervision that a very young child needs? And our culture's answer to that right now is keep them in schooling as long as we can. Mm-hmm. Growing without schooling posits something very different, says there are many other options here. And so what that means is that for let's say a 15-year-old who's not in school, you know, is technically homeschooling, there are all sorts of things that young person might be doing with her life, and she doesn't necessarily need any parent to be at home instructing her for 6 hours a day. So in that family kind of setup, both parents might very well work outside the home, or it might be a single parent. I always tell the story of it. There was a time when I was facilitating a discussion group of 5 homeschooled adolescent girls, and 3 of them were at that time living in single-parent families. It was not a problem in terms of whether homeschooling were an option for them or not, because, again, they certainly needed their parents' involvement and care and support and so forth. Every teenager ideally needs that, but they didn't need them to be teaching them all day long, because they were learning from such a variety of experiences and other people. Now, in a homeschooling family, there might be and, you know, frequently would be more than one child. And so you might have a homeschooled adolescent girl who's, let's say, 13 and has a couple of younger siblings. And the family might have in the early days arranged things and done what they could and chosen to live on a limited income and so forth. So that one parent could be at home during those years and be available to the children. So that adolescent girl, you know, as you see what I mean, might be living in a family in which the mother was home because there were younger ones. The family also might have worked out something where the parents might split shifts, you know, work in different kinds of ways, so someone was always available. They might be working from home, as is increasingly common now. There are options for that, you know, in this culture. They might be in some way doing some kind of work to in which the kids could be sometimes there or involved. So people work out all kinds of different creative solutions to this logistical problem, and in many ways it's more of a challenge when the children are younger than it is when they are older and involved in all sorts of different things. You know, a 16-year-old girl told me that she's sort of out and about all day long as a homeschooler, and so in that sense, what her parents did or didn't do was not as directly the issue during the daytime.
I have experience where I've heard a few girls telling me that, well, their mothers, well, she can clean because she's not really doing anything else. Kind of negative impression they're having of their mothers because their mothers weren't out there.
You know, it reflects a number of things, those comments. Then, I mean, of course, it reflects on the one hand a cultural societal bias against all that work that needs to happen but that society doesn't value or doesn't reward monetarily. You know, there's so many things that, so many issues that those comments highlight, you know, and one of them is the issue that only what our culture values by rewarding it with money is valuable and that sort of thing, and right on down to the sense of things that are traditionally women's work are less valuable. There's some other issues there as well. I mean, it's interesting that a number of the girls that I interviewed almost made the reverse comments, that they, because they did see what their mothers did at home, let's say even in those more traditional ways, and again, I don't want to imply that the gender roles were always split so conventionally, that it was in a homeschooling family, it's always the mother who does the cooking and cleaning and so forth, but whichever parent does it, a child who grows up much more aware of that, because the child is not off in school all day long, often develops, or certainly in the interviews that I did, I heard this, they develop a keen sense of what that work actually is, and therefore develop a respect for it, so that a girl might say, let's say in answering the interview question, what kinds of work do your parents do? And let's say, for the sake of discussion here, that I'm referring to a girl in my study who, where the parents did have, let's say it was the father who was having paid employment outside the home and the mother was not. The girl might report that by saying something like, my father is whatever, you know, whatever the work was that the father did, and my mother works plenty hard at home, or something like that. In other words, they would take care to acknowledge each kind of work. There's a lot there about how the mother sees the homeschooling life and so forth. And so that we've certainly, over the years at Growing Without Schooling, had a number of mothers report that it was through homeschooling their children that they developed a sense of their own interests and their own sort of goals and things they wanted to pursue, because as they were helping their children to do that, you know, it might be that they all took up an interest in a foreign language together. It might be that the mother began to reflect on her own past and her own schooling and on what she cared about. Sometimes a very beautiful thing happens, which is that the young person, being given the respect and attention to her own work all her life by her parents, then extends that back to her mother. So a classic story would be a mother who treated her children with a great deal of respect and then was trying at some point in her children's childhood to, the mother was trying to give some time to her own writing, to kind of build her own career as a writer, and was struggling with taking herself seriously in that way. And the daughter, the young daughter, encouraged her mother in that and, you know, would hang a sign on her mother's room saying, do not disturb, writer at work. You know, so really kind of returned the respect and the serious attention that her mother had given her. Sometimes it's a journey of discovery where they're having both together to talk about the cultural messages and assumptions and to figure out how they're going to see their lives and what they're going to give value to.
Well, there definitely is the idea that homeschooling is anti-feminist.
There's so much there, probably more than we can discuss now, about how feminism is defined. I mean, certainly in A Sense of Self, there's a discussion of that where, because that, you know, anticipating that question, I drew upon something that was outside the scope of the interviews for that book, but that had to do with work we had done at Growing Without Schooling around this issue where mothers had written in speaking to that. And many of them challenged very eloquently the claim that homeschooling is not a feminist cause or feminist experience, and that they will, I mean, it's very interesting that at a time when many women actually sort of are reluctant to define themselves as feminists and so forth, for whatever complex reasons that again, get outside the scope of this discussion probably, but these mothers would say, I consider myself very much a feminist. And they would say this, in some cases, as full-time homeschooling mothers, not mm-hmm. actually having any other, you know, paid employment and that sort of thing. So there's lots of ways of looking at things. There's a beautiful line from a single mother that wrote to us and said, homeschooling gave me my voice and the language to speak. You know, because there's another whole issue there. Sometimes it's through homeschooling that parents and specifically mothers become activists, become advocates, learn how to do that sort of thing. And, you know, it involves a great deal of trust in oneself. Sometimes it involves standing up to authority, depending on what their particular story has been and what's led them to homeschooling. But for many, it follows that. You know, that's their narrative of it, that it involves those sorts of things. So the point here is only that one cannot assume any one thing about it. That, you know, in this regard, that one has to look closer at people's actual experiences and how they see themselves.
Did you come to the whole idea of homeschooling and unschooling?
Well, I had read John Holt's books when I was a young person myself, a teenager. I was not thinking about homeschooling in particular then. Most of John Holt's books are not specifically about homeschooling, but they are his experiences as a school teacher and looking at what children's actual experience of school is like. That's what How Children Fail is about. It's a journal of his years as a fifth grade teacher. Fifth grade is 10 and 11-year-olds, and he was someone that paid close attention to children's experience. And I read that, and I thought, well, this is a teacher that knows what children's experience is. He understands what school is actually like for kids. You know, so few teachers seemed to be paying that kind of close attention to what school is really like for kids as opposed to what adults think it ought to be like. John Holt was one of the people that really noticed that difference. You know, one of the things he observed when he was watching his students closely was that their experience at school was very different from what he as a teacher hoped it would be, thought it should be, thought it might be, that sort of thing. So that's where I began, with that kind of close attention to children's actual experience of school, of childhood, of their relationships with adults, of learning and so forth. And when I gradually understood that John Holt had turned a lot of his focus to helping people who wanted to learn outside of school to do that and was publishing that magazine, I became interested in that as well. It's interesting that I have to speak to that, that people sometimes respond that way, saying it's amazing. And I want to speak to that, that there's a couple of things about that. First of all, in fact, to want to read about someone who's writing about one's own experience is, you know, in some ways pretty understandable, pretty natural. That, you know, when it, and I make this point because there's a lot of writing out there about education, of course, and about school reform and about what's wrong with schools and how we can make them better and all that sort of thing. And when we step back for a minute, take a sort of broad view and think about that, we might ask the question, why wouldn't young people be interested in that? You know, in other words, turn that around, that young people, after all, are certainly among the key stakeholders, as they say, in, you know, in the nonprofit world, in any kind of discussion about schooling and education and so forth. And so one way to look at that, when you take it broader than my own personal experience, is to say, in fact, it's the most natural thing in the world, for, you know, from another angle, that a young person would read this kind of literature about schooling and about education. John Holt also was an extremely clear writer. It just so happens. He's a wonderful prose stylist, wrote clear prose, and so it was not hard for a young person to find it accessible reading. And John Holt would have taken that as a great compliment. He wanted to write clearly enough that young people could follow him easily without, you know, sometimes we think that to write clearly enough, you have to be simplifying ideas, and John Holt didn't believe that. So I just come at that from another angle that, again, takes it away from whether it was or wasn't unusual for me personally to pick up a particular book and get interested in it. And increasingly, I think young people are having input into the discussion about school reform. You do see that to some degree more and more, that there will be articles or collections of interviews and so forth where people will turn to them directly. Growing Without Schooling magazine certainly continued that tradition, where we always had young people's writing integrated right in there with the adults' writing. Whenever we posed a question about education or homeschooling or children's learning or whatever it might be, we always posed it to the young people as well, and they responded. They were just right in there at the discussion table about that. I went to conventional schools. It was not really on my sort of radar screen, you know, the idea of actually leaving school. Again, I was interested in Holt's critique of schooling at that time and matching what he said to my own experience. Nowadays, things are different. There are books out there. There's so many books about teenagers who are actually leaving school. Grace Llewellyn's book, The Teenage Liberation Handbook, is, in a way, the classic example of that, that that's a book directed to young people, specifically saying, if you're unhappy in school, there is an option. There's also a whole community of teenage homeschoolers and so forth. So nowadays, if someone is reading critiques of schooling, they have more of the potential to, in fact, question whether they need to be there at all and to step out of school into a welcoming community.
The end!
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.